Good morning. We are back, Bostopian News, with Evan George, to bring you an incredible interview that I just did with Boston Education Justice Alliance Executive Director Ruby Reyes. And the interview speaks for itself. We're going to start that very, very soon. Just wanted to say that this interview was actually brought by one of my Patreon members, who is an activist within Boston Public Schools, who mentioned Ruby to me as somebody who would be great to interview. And really, this covers the gambit of problems that we've been seeing within BPS with the Marty Walsh administration all the way to where we are currently in January with the Wu administration. And so stick around, listen to that. And if you would ever like to help contribute to this show, pitch me ideas, or just support the show, as always, the best way to do that is to go to patreon.com/bostopiannews. Keeps all of my content free and helps support independent media here in Boston. And with that, here is our interview. Welcome back. We are joined by Ruby Reyes, the Executive Director of the Boston Education Justice Alliance. Ruby, thank you for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
Absolutely. And as we were just discussing, BPS is kind of this big, big thing in the background. Even when we look at like the city's budget, I believe it normally goes the operational budget, the capital budget, and they vote on the education budget separately. And it's almost like this third entity. And over the last 2 years, we've had almost like a state takeover of BPS. We've had a big debate over restructuring the school committee. Will we go back to an elected model versus one that's appointed? And then in January, we got a bunch of headlines saying that they could close half of all Boston public schools. And somebody who actually follows me reached out, wanted me to talk more about BPS, and she mentioned your name as somebody who would be great to have on and just talk about these issues. And obviously, it's hard of like, where do we hit the starting point for like the oldest public school system in the country to try to figure out what got us here. But I think the best way to start is with the Walsh administration and the McKinsey report that they authored in 2014, which seems like it advised Marty Walsh's plan in 2015 for Build BPS. So if you could start us off from there, what was this McKinsey report? What was some of the things that they outlined? And obviously, McKinsey is a well-known consulting firm, not just because of Pete Buttigieg, but they're normally behind most of the neoliberal policies that we see today. I think most recently they made headlines when they told ICE the best way to save money is to simply feed immigrants and asylum seekers less food while we have them in detention. So that's who we, you know, outsource this plan for. But again, what were their advice and what did Build the BPS look like?
Well, so just so you know, the Boston Education Justice Alliance, we work with parents, students, and educators. We create organizing campaigns to kind of make sure that the Boston Public Schools remain a beautiful thing for our families. And so I just want to say that, you know, our schools, the Boston Public Schools, like parents, students, educators, they love their schools. They love their, you know, their communities, right? And I think sometimes there's a huge disconnect between what the administration, as in BPS leadership, understands as a priority versus what the city leadership understands as a priority. And then what schools and families understand as a priority. So the McKinsey report, everybody's looking. So BPS is huge, right? And it's like this behemoth thing with lots of problems. And everybody's looking for like the silver bullet answer. And that's what Walsh was doing. And McKinsey tries to find silver bullet answers for very complex things. So it really doesn't, it in itself, like the McKinsey concept of how to problem solve is so flawed, right? Because you don't solve complex problems by like not talking to folks that know the answers, not talking to like parents, students, and educators who are experiencing the problems directly and know the answers. You just kind of come up with the silver bullet answer that takes X times X equals Y, right? And so that in itself is flawed. The McKinsey report, the reason that it is flawed is because it took X amount of square footage of schools, which included like hallway space, storage space, bathrooms, right? Divided it by X amount of students and said, you have way too much space for this amount of students. right? But it didn't take into account, right, that you don't use hallways, you don't use storage, right? Like the bathrooms aren't being used for classroom instruction. And so that's that in itself. They reported back to Walsh, like, you have too many schools. Your like footprint is too big for the amount of students that you have, right?
And it
And
is such like a
so
simplistic way of, because like you could take that formula and do it for anything. If I was like a manufacturer and then McKinsey, I asked for a consultancy, they would do, all right, what's the employee to warehouse space? And it just seems like a very arbitrary and like trying to, as you said, trying to reduce it to a silver bullet, just trying to get like a very simple math equation that then they can say, oh, well, according to this math equation that no one has ever said is how we should frame education. I mean, classroom space in terms of a teacher to student ratio is something that's well studied, and a lot of educators will look to that. The amount of space that is in a closet and then trying to create a fraction, as you were saying, is just it's a very dumb and very almost childlike like way of trying
right.
to reduce these complex problems.
Well, it's also like it doesn't take into consideration, right? Like, you also need therapeutic spaces with inclusion plan rolling out. You need more like one-on-one spaces. Like, those therapists, those clinicians that are like implementing special education services, right? Like, they need office spaces. They need, like, you know what I mean? Like, these spaces that don't fall into classroom spaces. Right, that everybody needs. It isn't just like hallway bathroom, but it's like you also need these additional spaces to like make things go well. And so, and in that, right, like that's what the McKinsey report produced. And Walsh was like, oh my God, we have too many schools. We need to close them. But we don't want to tell people that we're going to close their schools. So we're going to do it in this like really insidious way. We're going to call it Build BPS. We're going to put $1 billion into it. We're going to build 12 new schools and have like 12 major renovation projects, right? And so, and in that, they pitched, we're going to have these new schools, and that's Build BPS, right? But what it really
And
produced was nothing. Like, it produced school closures.
as
And
you
that's
said, the like the politics behind, all right, we're gonna cut. And you know, like as a side note, like as somebody who's like looked at how public entities use these private consultancies, it's normally they already know the answer or they already know the goal they want to get to, and they're just willing to spend kind of like millions of dollars for a private consultant firm to give us permission. Like you make up all that data, you create whatever like those fake formulas that like that you're going to use, and then I'll say, look, the smart people told us to do this, but in reality that was overall like the goal they already had in their mind. And as you said, very insidious, we're going to call it Build BPS, well really we're reducing it. And I think it was Megan Wolf who in a testimony for Boston City Council outlined not just some of like the school closures from the McKinsey report, but also things that they wanted to cut money around, and that was English language learners, special education. And I know those are also two big elements that we now see in reforms with Mayor Michelle Wu, and some of that has to do with deterring the state takeover. I definitely want to get us there. But first, just to finish with Build BPS. So that started in, I believe, 2015, and that was supposed to be a 10-year plan. We're about year nine right now. I know there's some overlap with the Wu administration, but how successful was it on its own merit? What was it trying to achieve, and did it achieve those goals?
No. So the many of the school closures that even happened weren't included in the original Build BPS plan. So like schools like the Jackson Mann, West Roxbury Educational Complex, McCormick Middle School, which like merged with BCLA, like all the school closure announcements that were made through Build BPS, and I say that because the McCormick didn't close, right? But the announcements that were made about their school closings were not even on the original list. So it wasn't even like they took an analysis of which buildings were in dire straits and needed to be replaced. It was just kind of like, oh, dang, we didn't realize that this building's falling apart and we have to close it. So they really didn't look into like a facilities assessment in order to determine like which schools would need new buildings.
This might be speculation, but if they didn't do something as simple as a facilities assessment, Which again, while I've worked in public education, in my mind, if somebody were to tell me, "Hey, we need to close some schools," and we'll talk about the big school closure and kind of the rationales and some of the problems with that in a little bit. But the first thing I would do would be look at the state of the buildings and try to figure out what buildings can't be saved because they're too old. Which ones could we just put a little bit of work into, and where are the new ones? But it sounds like they didn't even do that. So then, what were they basing this assessment on if it wasn't something as simple as the state of the buildings themselves?
They weren't basing it on an assessment. They were basing it on the McKinsey report, which only looked at the square footage of schools and like enrollment data. So it was just, it's so flawed in its statistical analysis. And I'll give you a prime example of how just flawed it was. So the Jackson Mann School, that school really does need to be torn down and rebuilt, right? They put in a brand new HVAC system into that school, knowing, well, I don't know if they knew, but they were going to have to close it, right? Like it wasn't gonna be able to withstand, right? Like the next 5 to 10 years. They put in a brand new, like Rolls-Royce HVAC system into that school. So when the pandemic started and everybody needed, like, these HERPA filters and all this stuff, right? Like they were one of the few facilities that had a brand spanking new HVAC system, but wasn't going to be able to stay open, right? So it's also like looking at the misuse of funds, right? Because everybody talks about how it is the biggest budget. And we do have students with the most complex needs, right? So our budget needs to reflect the needs and services for our complex students. Right. But they also just misused funds in that sense. Right. Like they misused, like it needed a new HVAC system. They could have started that process of like, okay, let's find swing space, right, in a facility that's able to sustain X number of students that are at the Jackson Mann, that are at the Horace Mann, right? They never at any point really started planning ahead in a way that would be less disruptive to families and students. So what they did was say, you guys are gonna stay here. We're not gonna, what are you talking about? Like this, we're fine. Like, don't worry. And then each year they wouldn't enroll new students, right? So the teachers, the parents, the educators, everybody knew that they were going down that route, but they kept lying and kept saying, like, no, we're not gonna, everything's fine. Like, what are you talking about? Like everything's gonna be fine. It's like we liken the, and I by we, I say like, you know, those of us that are doing advocacy work around BPS, we liken like leadership to kind of that scene in the Titanic where where it's like the orchestra is still playing. You know what I mean? And we're just, dude, like that isn't, this is not what's happening right now. Like we need to like, you know what I mean? If this school is going down and it's gonna close, like get the lifeboats ready. Like, you know, do these things to make sure that those families and those educators are like having a high quality education that is not disrupted, that their services aren't disrupted. But instead, it was like, no, everything's fine. We're fine. Like, what are you talking about? You guys are freaking out. Why are parents giving testimony at school committee? Like, what are you doing? You guys are crazy. And that's, I think, the crux of what makes it insidious is that not only did you not plan ahead, which is what you're supposed to do, right? Like, that's your whole job. You didn't do your job. But then on top of that, you lied to families, you lied to educators, you lied to like constituents. Right, about their education and their children's education. And that, like, people, like, you know, people fight tooth and nail for their children. And how can you justify that level of insidiousness, right? That level of gaslighting, that level of just really abusive behavior.
And that climate, that lack of communication, as you said, like that insidiousness, that just like lying about what is happening. It seems like we were still kind of like in the Walsh administration as you're outlining what was happening. And when Mayor Michelle Wu, I believe it was May 2022, announced we're going to do a Green New Deal for BPS. And one of the cornerstones of that was addressing that problem and saying, we are going to do like outreach and communication differently. Like one of the major quotes that she said, and this was quoted from the Boston Teachers Union, Green New Deal for Boston Public School is a pledge to listen and to rebuild trust with our communities. And there was another great quote. Let's see if I can set it here. This is just from a Globe article around the same time. And we talk about a change to this magnitude, it has to start and be centered with the community. That was a line from our superintendent, Skipper. That dialogue and conversation, sharing information, sharing data, that's part of our commitment, and that definitely feels different. So a lot of that branding when Michelle Wu first came on was, we are going to do outreach differently. We're going to do communication differently. You can trust us. You're going to be part of this conversation. This is now going to kind of, I'll start with that bigger question, and then we'll look at what some of the specifics are for the Green New Deal for Boston Public School. But overall, has the Wu administration, has there been a drastic change in communication? Are people feeling this connection? Where would you say that is? And is this a little bit, a lot more like the Walsh administration than it is something drastically different?
I mean, I think Mayor Wu's like overarching like theme for her campaign was community engagement. I will say that I think if anything, it's gotten worse because it's more almost like strategic in terms of like using community engagement language to justify less community engagement. So if that makes sense.
It
Yeah, I
does,
think.
and you know that like I don't want to say co-opting. That might mean like I'm attributing a little bit of like harsh intent, but it is like using the language that is meant to be restorative. It is meant to be good, but then using it to justify doing the exact opposite. There's a lot of like TikTok videos about like when boys go to therapy and they use therapy language to gaslight, and it's like
Right.
a little bit of that context. But please continue.
That's exactly. What is happening right now under the Wu administration? And I can give you like an example, right? So we were one of the organizations, like we fought so hard not to go into state receivership because what state receivership would have done was basically remove all decision making from families, from educators, from like the community. What little process we had for community engagement would be completely removed by the state. We would be under state control, right? And the state does not have the capacity to make Boston Public Schools better. Like we've seen their track record in other cities where they have receivership and they've epically failed. So they would have not only epically failed us, right? But it would have been at like such a large magnitude. Right. And so for us, it was like, no, we cannot go under state receivership. Like, there's no way we can go from like bad to worse. Right. And so we fought super hard to not go into state receivership. We didn't go into state receivership. We instead had this like systemic improvement plan that's basically a contract with the state that Mayor Wu facilitated with Commissioner Jeff Riley. And they signed together with Jerry Robinson. Right. So it's a contract with the state saying these are the areas that we're going to improve on. All of that work, right, that families, that educators like really fought to keep, right, like their schools for them was out the door because it was like ultimately that improvement plan happened between our mayor, Mayor Wu, and Commissioner Jeff Riley. So there was no community engagement. There was no like, are these like the main goals that need to be had? Like, are these the main areas that we need to be working on? And that's kind of how everybody got edged out. And quite honestly, like Mayor Wu is not the education mayor. She hadn't hired a senior advisor on education at that point. The person that she hired to be the senior advisor on education. I think it's like the title is like youth and something like that, was out of Somerville, was not like a former Boston Public School educator, administrator, like wasn't even a resident, right? Like, or I don't know if she was a resident at the time, but was like coming out of Somerville. And so the relation, like the Somerville public school system, is very different from BPS, right? Just like Mary Skipper came out of Somerville, they don't have a transportation system that's as complex as ours. They have like walk to school transportation. So that alone, right? Like they don't have the same experience that, and the level of need and understanding of the complexity as what is needed for Boston Public Schools. And so that is who we have, right, in terms of leadership leading like this work. And that is how folks were moved out of any kind of decision making. Like it was between Commissioner Riley, who was a former Boston Public School administrator many, many years ago, right? And Mayor Will.
And just before like we talk about like what came about that agreement, you know, those two big fields, special education and ELL reform that have been popping up in the news in terms of, you know, I think a lot of people resigned from their position from a task force because of these changes. Just staying with like that Green New Deal for BPS, because obviously that, you know, that title Green New Deal, everyone who follows politics or even just loosely reads the news knows that it has to do with like green infrastructure. And Mayor Michelle Wu, when she was running, very much, you know, presented herself as like a, as you're saying, not the education mayor, but I think definitely, I think presented herself as like a Green New Deal mayor, like a her focus on public transportation, for example. And so I always took like her saying Green New Deal for Boston Public School as like a umbrella branding for herself and just trying to like get more people to look at it. But there were actual like green initiatives involved in this. What were some of those? And is that like much more minor? And again, is this really more branding, or was changing like the energy infrastructure of Boston Public Schools, is that like a big cornerstone of what she's trying to do?
I mean, I think really it's about branding. I think she wants good things for the Boston Public Schools, but is also just trying to get reelected if she runs again, right? And so, like, I'll give you a good example of like a Green New Deal thing that she highlighted in the media. So as she was like taking pictures on the electric buses that were purchased, right? It was like pictures of her and Mary Skipper. It was like families were still not getting to school on time, right? Like it's like you want to transform something, but you're not, even solving the current problems. So the pictures were of the new electric buses being purchased, but the reality was that, transportation at the beginning of the school year was still a mess,
I
right?
think the stat I saw was 4 in 10 buses arrived late, on the first, so 40%.
Right. And so it's just, that was one of the major issues with the systemic improvement plan, right? Was transportation, which it has gotten better. Like from last year, transportation has gotten better. But a lot of the key issues, when you kind of like scratch the surface, were not based in having an electric school bus. They were based in the fact that, there wasn't enough bus monitors that were hired, and that had to do with like their pay rates. There wasn't like bus drivers needed to have like, a new contract that was like, put in place, and things were being done differently around that contract with TransDev, the provider for the buses, and how bus drivers were being compensated. And so it was like all these infrastructure needs that were not a picture of an electric school bus. You know what I mean? Like you want to be the Green New Deal mayor and want to take pictures with an electric school bus, but in reality, it's kind of like an Instagram post, like the people that are posting that their life is so great, once you scratch the surface that their life is in shambles, right?
Yeah.
But
And I
it's like,
mean,
let's post that cute picture.
yeah. And like, you know, as you said, the major problems were not the fuel energy source that our buses were using. There are a lot more logistical problems. Now, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't push to an electric school bus system or have those reforms, but you know, it is very easy relatively easy to purchase new vehicles than it is to change a system. And so, just focusing on like the shiny new object that you can post on your Instagram photo is a little bit different than solving those complex problems, but you can do both at the same time. And there's really no reason why we're not. But now, as you said, that lack of communication, lack of community engagement, completely pushed out. We had this agreement really behind closed doors with the mayor administration, the superintendent, and at the state level, Jeff Riley. And two of the big things that we had to create these action plans around was special education and ELL, and specifically around the concept of inclusion for both. And so maybe taking English language learners first, it looks like Mayor Michelle Wu put together a task force of, how should we best educate our bilingual students, our students who English might be a second language, our students who might not speak any English? What are the best practices for us to do that? And it seems like Mayor Michelle Wu completely sidestepped that task force and said, all right, here's the plan. And I believe that resulted in, I think, 9 of 13 members resigning, essentially saying, you're not listening to best practices, you have something else in mind. And that something else in mind is around this inclusion model. So can you just briefly explain what is that inclusion model, and why is it that so many people who are experts in this field, who have knowledge of this field, are saying this is not the right way of doing it?
So I'm gonna, okay, so English learners are separate from special education. And I think that in itself is crux for where the problems are starting. So this inclusion rollout says we're gonna have full inclusion across schools. So what inclusion is that you have X number of general education students who don't re require, right, like additional services. And then you have X amount of students who are in special education and require X amount of like additional services. And so what is defined as a special education student is a student who's on an individualized education plan, which says like it's a contract, which says, you need these services, and the parents have to sign off on it. The student, like everybody reviews it and says, okay, yeah, right. And so it varies. Like some kids need more. Just individualized like reading time, or and it varies depending on the needs of the student, but it's an individualized plan, right? And then you have 504 plans, which is also a form of special ed, which are like special accommodations, right? And so when you have inclusion, you have the majority of your classes right now are general education with no special ed students in there, right? And so when you do inclusion, you're gonna mix them up. And so that requires you to have more staff, right? English learners is different. It's separate. When you're in an English learner program, you're not just thrown into general ed. You're receiving a, special education, but not as a sped student, as a general ed student who requires English learner supports, right? And so there is a state law. It isn't like a plan, it's like state law. So state law first said, like, we're gonna do away with bilingual ed. Everybody's gonna be in gen ed. Like, good luck with those English learners. Like, hope they learn School of Hard Knocks, right? And then that changed. It wasn't like that always, right? It was like, no, we provide native language literacy, right? And native language literacy is where you have a teacher or a person who's educating, these students in their native language, right? So it acknowledges that they speak another language and that they, they learn in another language. And so that is state law now, right? Like you have to provide native language literacy, right, to your native language learners. So that in itself is what is wrong with how the English learner plan is being rolled out. It's not about best practice. Well, it is about best practices, but it's also about state law. And so state law says with the New Look Act, it overturned that previous laws, which said like, good luck English learners, like learn by the School of Hard Knocks, right? To we have to provide native language literacy.
And
So
do you know what year that law passed that said that like we you need to provide native language literacy, or like even like a time frame?
I don't know the I don't remember the time frame, but it's called the Look Act. And it was, I want to say it was like within, I don't know. I want to say it's like within the past like 5 or 6 years, but then I could be wrong. And then it's gonna be like, oh, I can't believe.
No, that's if you had to I don't know, using betting terms, over 2000, like the 21st century or the 20th century.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
Okay,
And so it's
so at
like,
some point in the 20, I mean, honestly, that's fine because we had, a big federal level push for changes in education, like the Bush era, the early 2000s, No Child Left Behind, and then I think if I had to guess, I bet you maybe 10 years later, probably like in the early like 2010s, Massachusetts changed this law. But what was the name of the act again?
the Look Act. So that required you to provide native language literacy. So what ends up happening in BPS was
2017. Continue.
2017. There you go. So, I wasn't too bad
No,
off.
you are. Again, trust your instincts. 5 to 10 years, you're right on. All right, continue.
Right. So it's like, at this point, English learners should be getting native language literacy. Right. But what ends up happening, what ended up happening, or what is happening in BPS is like they'll assess a child and that child won't speak English. And they'll be like, oh, he didn't do well in the assessment. So we have to put him in a small classroom setting. That's what he needs. I'm going to just say he or she needs. Right. And those are called sub-separate classrooms and therefore special education students. Right. And so a sub-separate classroom is like all the students in that class are on an IEP. And so they're like, this kid doesn't speak English, didn't do well on these like assessments. So we're gonna put them in there, right? But it's like that's not necessarily what the kid needs. The kid maybe does have special needs, right? But is not receiving instruction in their native language. And so all of these assessments, like the MCAS and things like that, right? Like they're in English. And it's, so you're not necessarily assessing what you should be assessing. And so therefore you have this high population of English language learners being put into special ed incorrectly, right? And
And then just for my edification, so they're being placed in special education classrooms, and in those special education classrooms, they are not receiving the instruction in the native language. They're being grouped as if they have a learning disability or a behavioral modification that is so severe that they need to be separate.
right. And so still, like, you'll have kids who just like don't know English just sitting there all day, like not learning. And it's heart-wrenching because it's like these are brilliant children, right? Not that any of our children, like everybody is capable of learning, and so they're just sitting there, like not understanding what's happening, not and it's like give them native language literacy instruction that the state requires, and
And
that means like,
instead of doing that, again, the state required that from 2017, you have to provide the instruction in the child's native language. This new plan that the Wu administration has formed with the state, it seems to just simply be no, just put them in the regular general education classrooms, just sidestep that law.
well, it's more like the inclusion plan says all of our classes are going to be not just all general ed, right? Like there's going to be a mix of students. Not all, but there will be some, you know what I mean? And so as they're moving into this phase of having not just all general ed classes, but classes where it's like general ed and special needs, they're just kind of throwing them in there, right? And so A, that does like inclusion and special ed are different from English learners, right? Like their instruction, their needs, very different. And so you do have students with disabilities who are English learners, right? But if you're gonna, but you can't just, the reason that I think many of the special ed task force members resigned, and I don't want to speak for them. But the reason that they resigned is because the inclusion plan is basically like we're going to lump in English learners into this. So it's essentially saying we're not going to do the things that we're supposed to do. We're just going to throw them into the mix, right? And again, like sink or swim, right? And that's not what is supposed to happen. What's supposed to happen is supposed to get native language literacy.
And it seems like in 2022, again, when all this is happening, there was a proposal, or I shouldn't even say proposal, a plan that was to add 25 new bilingual programs to Boston Public Schools. And I'm just reading now from a Boston Globe article. I think it was on the last day of 2023. Just the quote: "A revised plan from October makes no mention of the 25 new dual language programs the district had previously pledged to launch." So I guess what happened? Because it seems like they had that plan that it sounds like from what you're saying, in accordance with state law, that would have provided this instruction in the child's native languages. And then for some reason, it just seems to have disappeared. Is that because again, this is all the same year, like 2022, all this is happening. Is that because of an agreement with the state that that just got dropped? And does anyone know?
Nobody knows. Like, that's the plan that they submitted under the systemic improvement plan. They're supposed to launch those 25 bilingual ed programs this coming year, like September. You're supposed to have 25 bilingual ed programs, right? And it's like there is a moment when I read that plan and I was like, this is just garbage. Like, they're not gonna do, there's no way, like, your timeline is completely off. Right? You're saying you're going to do this in 3 years, but in 2 years, you're going to launch 25 programs? Like, that doesn't even make sense. It's a 3 year plan with two year, you know what I mean? So it just like logically didn't make sense. And it was not going to make sense that they would start 25. So I read it and I was like, this is not real, right? This is like fiction that they're sending to the state. But they sent it to the state and the state was like, oh, thanks. Right. And so, like, the state is also complicit in all of this. Right. And so, for us, like, when people were like, well, things are so bad, maybe the state, I'm like, no, they're even worse. Right. Because they're complicit in it and they're okay with that. And so, the level of accountability that's not happening is like at all levels. Right. And so, then you're going to like launch these 25 programs and it's like, where is like the movement on that plan? Like, we knew you weren't going to do it, but like, can you launch four? You know, like, you know,
Yeah,
like.
especially for an administration that loves pilot programs, which I mean, I'm for them, especially if it's something new. It is a great way of trying to understand. I think sometimes we don't need to because we know what works, we know what doesn't. We can just get into it. But something like this, if we want to do a slow rollout, that would be how you would do it. But as you were saying, it just seems like it was simply just meant to pacify on paper the state, where everyone looking at it was thinking this is not feasible. And getting back to that problem of communication, from the same article discussing ELL, and then I want to move on to like the recent school closures. You've been very generous with your time, thank you. The quote is: "Some Spanish-speaking families have begun circulating an online petition demanding that BPS immediately postpone implementing the inclusion plan, arguing that parents weren't given enough time to participate in or understand it." And it seems like this is just going along with the worst practices of the Walsh administration in terms of communication, something that we were told this is what's drastically different about the Wu administration's plans, but definitely seems to be more of the same. And I guess that now pivots us to the school closures. And this really seemed, and as you were saying, there's been school closures for years and years in Boston Public Schools. Like they have been reducing the amount of buildings, and we had some under the Walsh administration as well. But the big announcement in June of last year that the O'Brien School would be just moving from Roxbury to West Roxbury. How was the community engagement in that process? And can you just really update us on what is this re th th this moving of the school? Why are they doing it? What is the timeline? Just give us the basics.
I mean, the O'Brien announcement was made in front of the Madison Park School. In front of the building, like in front of the entrance of the John D. O'Brien School. And it was Mayor Wu and Mary Skipper who had this press conference to make this announcement, right, in June. And as they were giving the press conference with the announcement for the proposal to move them, educators, students, and parents were getting an email saying that this was the proposal, right? So there literally had been no community engagement whatsoever. And clearly they knew because they had a press conference as families were receiving this information, right? As educators, we're receiving this information is when the announcement was happening outside their school. So I think to me that was the most telling example of how bad, like when we talk about the Walsh administration, it's like the Wu administration is on steroids around the lack of community engagement and gaslighting. And this is like a prime example. She had a press conference never having sent out any information to anyone.
And
And
like when you
so,
say like on steroids, really it just means like they are better at it, because if you want to control a narrative, that is how you would do it. We're going to tell everyone at the same time, and I'm going to make the announcement. So every news report is just going to say what I'm saying because it's the mayor speaking. But if I were to contact all the parents and say, hey, we're considering this, well, then the media is going to run with the parents' reactions to that email, and that is what frames the narrative. And so it's not just following what the Walsh administration was doing in terms of we are making these decisions without you, but it is also, as you were saying, just doing it in a much cleaner, sharper way that makes it look like this community engagement because of how she presents it. But in reality, it is almost even more drowning out any communication because they're so good at messaging.
right. I would say that to this day, the parent council co-chairs of the former parent council from last year and this year have never been contacted, ever. Like, ever. And so, like, the degree of, I think, just lack of respect for families, I think, is just at a disturbing level. In terms of timeline, what is happening is the families that are involved that are at the O'Brien, they organized a hearing on December 5th with Julie Mejia and Tanya Fernandez Anderson were the two counselors who chaired that meeting and like put that hearing helped families put that hearing together. And since that time, they the three panelists from the city were Dion Irish, who's in charge of Capitol, Delaverne Slanislaw, who's the BPS Capitol person, and then Tali Robbins, who's the senior advisor, I think, to Wu. And they were so disturbingly unprepared. Dion Irish made a comment about how that was part of their community engagement plan, that hearing that those families put together. Not that the Wu administration, not that, BPS put together to hear from families, right? And so at every stage of the game, they've been having these tours of the West Roxbury Educational Complex. At one of the tours, the majority, they asked at the end, like, do you want us to move the O'Brien here? And the majority of families did not raise their hands. And they put out in the press that the majority of families wanted to move there. And so, I think the timeline around that is that they have not voted on it at school committee. We've been told that the school committee will have the final decision on whether to move that school out there. They haven't voted on it. It hasn't been brought up. And so families are still organizing around it. I know that they're working to meet with the Wu administration. They did request to meet with Mayor Wu, which, they did all the formal, like, you're supposed to submit a form. They did all that, never heard from them. The Nubian Square Coalition, went to City Hall and like demanded to meet with the mayor, and they met with her for a little while. And then she kind of like ushered them off to meet with her advisors. I know that they have met with Dion Irish and David Lee, the architect who designed Roxbury Community College and like these other major buildings in Roxbury. I know has agreed to like even start looking at alternative plans and designing alternative plans if hired by the city to keep students in that space. Like the Madison Park complex, there's other issues. Like the Madison Park complex is going to be renovated. Like Madison Park is going to be renovated for that voc ed school. But that whole area has buildings that are unused, parking lots, like areas that are completely undeveloped. And I think the original plans, some of the buildings were not included in there. So the O'Brien families were like, what the heck? Like, you could use these buildings. You could have us be in more than just like one floor. Like, you can develop a design that has multiple floors to fit everyone. So it's just like the level of teetering between stupidity and insidiousness is just really questionable. Like, you know, I think there are many incredible architects, including David Lee, who are willing to kind of say, like, you know, it is possible to keep these both schools with renovated spaces, with expansion of seats in the footprint that we have, if we like A, use all the footprint, which is not currently being used, and then B, like, build up. And so, you know, I think there's definitely like easy alternatives that are cheaper and healthier for families. But I don't think the Wu administration wants that, right? Like, they want to rebuild the school in West Roxbury and put an exam school in there. And so who do they pick to put an exam school in there but the most diverse of the three exam schools to kind of get rid of families of color, right? It's like the exam schools are for white families in Boston. And how do we further make that very much, you know, a priority by taking away the one exam school that's
Yeah,
the most
that's what
diverse?
like made this so puzzling to me, because how it's presented is almost like, you know, they stumbled upon this beautiful space in West Roxbury, and they thought we should move a school here. And well, like in my mind, like if there's a beautiful space out there for a school, why don't we just build a new school there? Why are we taking one that's already established and just kind of like ripping it out and putting it in that location? That to me, it would just make a lot more sense. If you're saying there's a beautiful space for a school, we could just build a new school there. If you wanted a new exam school, I mean, I think all exam schools should be abolished, but that has more to do with my views on public education. But if then create another one, why are we taking one from this area? And to me, the only logical reason would have been something as this entire school is going to crumble in 5 years. And so like the infrastructure is gone. We need a new space for it. Here's a new space. But it sounds like what you're saying, that's not necessarily the case. You could use that space, or in the very close existing area, there's more than enough space for a school. And this would just be kind of a drastic relocation and really just like rooting out of a school that's already focused within a community. And I guess, and you know, kind of just coming up on this much larger topic as we're slowly closing about school closures. And you know, the announcement that the news ran with was in terms of this long-term plan that BPS announced. I think the official title, as I'm trying to think of what it was called, long-term facilities plan. And in it, it looked like it could be up to 50% of schools closing. And so I guess if you want to just explain what is happening? Are we losing 50% of schools? I have some theories about how this was presented in the media. But yeah, so overall, what is happening with this long-term facilities plan?
Well, first of all, we fought to have a long-term facilities plan. Like, our organization, as well as many other activists in Boston, were like, you can't just keep like making announcements, giving us piecemeal. Like, you have to have like a long-term plan, right? And so in that, Mayor Wu agreed to that in the systemic improvement plan. You have to have like part of the systemic improvement plan was like, we're going to do an assessment of schools. There's going to be an assessment. It's completed, and we're going to have a long-term facilities plan. And in the systemic improvement plan, they call it a comprehensive master facilities plan. Like, that's the exact language that they agreed to, right? So then Wu comes in and says, well, Wu and Skipper or whoever the powers that be, right, were like, oh no, it is really irresponsible for us to have a long-term facilities plan because enrollment is changing, communities are changing. So we're going to develop this rubric instead on how we make decisions. And it's like, that's not a plan. And there's already an evaluation tool in place called the equity planning tool that BPS uses to make major decisions that take into account like stakeholder engagement and like, you know, these different factors in order to like make less racist decisions, right? And so
It's
that
so
was a
funny because,
key
like,
dismissal of that, the equity planning tool for this rubric that they developed in order to not have a master facility plan.
Because it's almost, going back to the beginning of our conversation, like what the McKinsey Institute, a consulting firm, did, which is we're going to create a formula which gets us to the decision we want, and then you can't get mad at us because that's what the formula says. And as you're saying, but we have other ways of assessing this. We have other formulas. You were deliberately choosing this artificial
Not
thing that you
use
made
them.
up to get to this conclusion.
Exactly. And so, I think for us, we were like infuriated because we had got finally like, oh my gosh, we're going to have a comprehensive plan. Like families are going to be able to plan. We know which schools are going to be closed because of the building assessment. None of that is in the plan. The plan, like if you're going to close 50 schools, which are they? Tell us, right? But they don't even do that. And so we know that they know which schools need to be taken offline because they finished the assessment plan. Tell us, right? And so I think part of it is like there's the reality that we do need new school buildings. Build them. Build new schools.
As you say, to me, it's like, and you made this comment, it's about respect, which is like, there are very intelligent people, like parents, educators, do understand that, okay, if the building is crumbling, if enrollment is drastically decreasing, then okay, like we understand that school closures may need to occur, either because the buildings themselves, maybe we could do a better job with allocating where our students go. That makes sense where current like families live because of that changing dynamic. Everyone can treat each other as adults with respect and talk through those issues. But the problem is they don't. And like we see this in housing policy all the time, that if you just explain what is happening, then we can
Like if
all.
your school building is about to crumble and fall to the ground,
No
right?
parent would want their kid there. Every parent would say, this is not safe. Absolutely. This is a safety issue. I don't want my kid going to a place where a piece of concrete's going to fall on their head. Okay, let's look at some new locations. Like, that's a
Build
very
a new
easy thing.
school, right? Like, where are the new schools? Walsh had 10 years. Where are the new schools? Right, Wu is like developing this other plan. Where are the new schools? Like, it's always like we have to close schools in order to build new schools. It's like, no, you can just build new schools, like, build them, And for us, it's like very telling that again, you can walk and chew gum at the same time, right? So, like, if you know from your building assessment that this school is not going to be able to be open past 10 years. You build a new school or you identify swing space, you put that school community there while you're building that new school, and then you put them in there, right? Because I think what's really just gravely missing from the conversation is that these schools are communities. They're communities for children, they're communities for families, they're communities for educators, right? And those things are inextricably linked. Like a kid doesn't go to school because they have like a nice window. They go to school because they have a favorite teacher, because their friends are there, because they love like this event that their school puts on every year, because they feel cared for, right? Parents are like, oh my God, I have a great relationship with my son's teacher. She texts me pictures of him, doing whatever. Like, those are the things that make education fruitful. For those being directly impacted, those are the things not being considered. Instead, what is happening is we know that these like 5 or 10 schools or whatever are gonna like come crumbling down. Let's just pretend that that's not gonna happen. And then let's just move people wherever and like we'll deal with the backlash later. And it's like that's not a healthy way for anybody to live, because then BPS families are like, well, is my school going to close next year? I don't know. Like, should I be looking for another school for my kid? Like once you register your kid and they're in a happy place, it's like, word, let me ride that train. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
Like, they're going to stay here till 6th grade and then I'm going to find them another school. And then hopefully it'll be a school where their like friends are going so
that was
that
exactly
they
the
have
point
that
I
like,
was going to make, is that like missing from this is also the social connections that children build. And I grew up in Haverhill, Massachusetts, had multiple different middle schools and things like that, but a lot of the same kids that I went to class with in 1st grade were in my classes in 12th grade.
right.
And while fully understand you might have different elementary and middle school, like we moved around a little bit, but that social connection, and it's not as easy as just, oh, we'll just rip that kid out and move them. Like that has drastic consequences that, as you were saying, sadly just doesn't even seem to be considered. Never mind parent-teacher connections. And at some level, Michelle Wu and her
Community
administration must
connection.
know this. And, you know, her
Right.
big shiny program that she announced at the State of the City was this partnership with BPS and museums in Boston. And, you know, every expert on this is saying this is such a great idea because community engagement happens in schools. And this is how parents find out about programs like this. They're not going to find out about it through reading the Globe or because they know someone who works at City Hall who tells them. Their kids find out because the teachers communicated. And we saw this during COVID as well. A lot of the best information was being shared from parents to teachers, well, teachers to parents, teachers to students, students to their parents. That is a natural network that you need. And ripping kids and families apart just destabilizes that area. And I guess as a last closing question, do you think, you know, starting that with that McKinsey study, Walsh administration, Wu administration, they are looking at the demographic changes and saying Boston is deliberately moving in the direction of this is going to be for young urban professionals. It's going to be where you move to for college. And then right after college, you're going to live in studio apartments. Maybe you'll live in four bedrooms with three other people you met on Craigslist, my example. And this is who we're gearing the city to. And you look at all the changes in housing. All the changes in housing are geared towards that population, like rich or young urban professionals. This is not a place for families. However, we can't market that. We can't say that to voters. No one wants to live in an area like that. And unfortunately, so they are making the hard decision to hide this from us while they move the city in that direction. Do you think it's that, or am I just kind of putting, I don't know, words in your mouth?
I think I just said this in a meeting on Monday, where I feel like the Seaport is the bright, shiny example of how disturbing of a direction the city's going in. Like, the Seaport District is essentially a gated community for millennial professionals who are white, and there's more dogs than there are children in the Seaport. And that breaks my heart because a
Wow,
society
that's a
without
quote.
children is just absolutely useless. It's useless. It's a useless society. Like, it is a decayed society. And so the reality is that this city, like, that we need a mayor that is actually wants families here and is doing things to ensure that they can stay here. And you know, the gentrification levels that are happening in Boston, like, we're leading the way on gentrification, on moving working class families out of the city. We're leading the way on, like, racism, systemic racism in the O'Brien decision. Like, researchers around STEM were like, this is, you don't take, you know, like, people make connections and build relationships for STEM, not through their location, but through each other, right? And so when you do that, you destroy a STEM school. So we're leading the way on that. Right. And so, and it's all very much linked. It's all very much in relationship because the reality is that even as we're talking about, like, you know, children and families building these relationships with their educators and their community and their principal, right? Like, those people live in the city. Like, do we want them to live here? And then the reality is that those schools are part of community networks, right? And so, do we want our communities to flourish? And, like, that's the real question. And it's just disturbing because it's, I live in Dorchester. I don't want Dorchester to look like the Seaport. I wouldn't want to live here. You know what I mean? Like, I love the fact that I can walk up the street and get Jamaican food as a Mexican. Like, I love it. You know what I mean? That's not, you know, it's just, it's so, I don't want that for Boston. I don't want that for Boston public school families, for educators. It's so sad. Like, I don't want Boston to be a city that isn't for families. I want it to be for children. Like, this is the crux of, like, I think what most politicians should be asking themselves. Like, you know, you plan ahead as a family for where your child's going to be, right? Like, you don't plan ahead based on, like, I'm not a career.com person, but, like, that's what families are planning for. Like, where are their kids going to be going to school? Where is their friend? Like, you know, I talked to this parent at one of the schools that we met with their staff and stuff. And the parent was like, I didn't put my kid in Metco because I can't take them to have a play date in Wellesley. Like, they can have play dates here. They can, you know what I mean? Like, their friends from like their school live up the street, just like I do, right? And so people don't talk about how important that community building component is, that you know your neighbors through your kids. Like, that's beautiful. And why would you want to destroy that? Like, I don't understand that. Like, why wouldn't you want to foster that instead? And so I find that all very disturbing that the seaport even exists the way that it does. And it's going to go under soon anyway, like because of climate change.
The ocean will wash this all away.
Exactly. My
But
mom was like, when all that happened, I think like last year, where like the trash cans were going through the street, she was like, "Are you okay? Is that your..." I was like, "No, mama, that's where the rich white people live. Like, they can afford it. They'll be all right. They're living in towers, you know?" And it's just like, what is the city really doing when it talks about equity, right? Like, that's not equitable. Like, for you to serve those that are already like doing well. Like, equity is about making sure that everyone has what they need based on what their needs are. So those that are struggling are able to get more because they're struggling. Like, give them more, right? And so I think that's part of like the crux of what Mayor Wu needs to be asking herself, what Superintendent Skipper needs to be asking herself. Like, who are they really working for? Like, a lot of these decisions are politically based. They're not based on the needs of parents, students, and educators.
No, absolutely. And that's a great way to end it. Ask you to just stick around for 1 second. But Ruby Reyes, Executive Director for the Boston Education Justice Alliance, thank you so much.